National Gallery podcast.
Hello, I'm Miranda Hinckley, and this is the National Gallery podcast. Coming up,
the circus performers, a grotesque old woman, so you've got to be kind to her, a mad pet-hating scientist, very difficult to say but very enjoyable to watch, and you can take part in a beard-growing contest. More than that, I can't say.
The National Gallery through children's eyes. We hear about the launch of a new audio guide for families that invites the kids to take charge. First, though, the gallery's next major exhibition. Pompeo Bertone is an artist you may not have heard of, but in the 18th century he was an international star. Hailed as the saviour of Italian painting, he was also a brilliant portraitist, adored by British aristocrats travelling on the Grand Tour. Being painted by Bertone in Rome was a highlight of this fashionable expedition around Europe's cultural capitals, and the paintings that were brought back hang on the walls of many of the nation's stately homes. One house, however, has a collection that's particularly fine. Uparc in West Sussex is now a National Trust property and is contributing several works to the new show. To find out more, we sent Leah Caribbean along to talk to Alistair Lang, the National Trust's curator of pictures and sculptures.
Well, we're here at Uparc, a beautiful William and Mary house, which in the mid-18th century was the home of Sir Matthew and Lady Sarah Featherstone Hall. And like many National Trust properties, it's closed for the winter, but it's being opened for us specially today by the keepers here. And we're coming inside. And we're going to make our way first, Alistair, I think, to where the portraits of the Featherstone Whores, which are going to be in the National Gallery exhibition, are hung. So we've come into the red drawing room, and I see that all the furniture here, as you do at National Trust properties in winter, is under close covers, these fabric covers that protect the furniture. But this is very much as it would have been when the Featherstone Whores were away.
Very much so. They would have shut up the house when they went away, and dust covers would have been put over everything to protect the furniture, in fact, less from the dust, or not only from the dust, but also from the light, because wood can fade very badly when exposed to the light.
Now, this is also the room where the two portraits of the Featherstone Whores, Sir Matthew and Lady Sarah, would have been hung. We can see, actually, at the moment, the empty spaces where their portraits are currently in Houston are going to be arriving at the National Gallery on the 20th of February. But they were unusual, weren't they, for grand tourists? Because I suppose our typical view of the grand tourist was son of the aristocracy who goes off to complete his education. But the Featherstone Whores were different.
They certainly were. They were almost unique, certainly amongst Bertone's sitters, in being a family group. And that consisted of Sir Matthew and his wife, Sarah, and his brother, Utrecht, and a companion for his wife called Catherine Durnford, who was daughter of the local parson, and between whom and his brother, Utrecht, an affection developed so that they married when they came back.
Also had a bit of a romance as well as a grand tour. But the Featherstone Whores were also unusual, weren't they, in the fact that they were among the very first British travellers to sit to Pompeo Bertone in Rome. In the 1751, aren't they, that those first two...
1751 and yes, 1752.
That they also seem to have a slightly different look to them from the sort of typical Bertone grand tourist portrait that we've become used to.
They do indeed, because the classic Bertone portrait, which is actually represented in this room by the portrait of Sir Matthew and Lady Featherstone Hall's son, Harry, who was painted in 1776, is to have some classical detail, a vase or a sculpture or a plan of the Pantheon or something. In this case, it's a vase. The Featherstone Hall party are represented as hunters, and Sir Matthew and Lady Featherstone Hall even possibly as classical hunters, because Lady Featherstone Hall has a crescent moon in her hair to denote her as Diana, the goddess of hunting.
Those two portraits, they stand out because they've got these dogs in them as well. I mean, is it a case that the dogs were portraits, do you think?
It's certainly very possible, because one of the things that travellers did like taking with them, in addition to quantities of luggage, which sometimes required a carriage of its own, was to take their pets, and particularly their dogs, with them. And Bertone seems to have had particular sensitivity towards dogs, because he includes them in a number of his portraits.
Right, and I'm fascinated, I mean, looking at the portrait of Sir Harry here, and fascinated by this idea of the Grand Tour passing down through generations, that, you know, Sir Matthew and Lady Sarah go, and then their son goes in time. Sir Harry himself, I understand, was a bit of a character.
Well, he was. On the Grand Tour, he was probably kept in order because, interestingly, Utrecht, who'd been on the first tour, his uncle, acted as his sort of guide and tutor and probably kept him or tried to keep him on the straight and narrow. But after he came back to England, his father had died, he was had a vast fortune, he fell in with the Prince of Wales and led a fairly...
always bad.
Always bad. Well, the past Prince of Wales we're talking about. And led a rather wild life, which included taking up the young Emma Hart, much better known as later as Lady Hamilton, as his mistress, although I regret to say that he packed her off to the country when she became pregnant.
Now, have I heard a story that she danced naked on the dining table here at Uppark, or is that totally mythology, do you think?
Well, it was certainly passed down in the annals of the family as having happened. We can't know whether it did or not.
Now, we're going to go to another room, which is not the dining room, I hasten to add, but the saloon. And it's just a beautiful room with the most splendid plaster ceiling and with paintings hung all round, a sort of classical theme to the fireplaces. And it seems that, I mean, looking at a room like this, which seems to me the sort of quintessential, stately home room, I mean, it seems that British taste, what we have come to accept as a sort of British heritage, really seems to have been profoundly affected by the Grand Tour and encounters with artists like Battoni.
Very much so, because even those that didn't go to Italy, as Dr. Johnson famously said, felt an inferiority for not having done so, and some of those who weren't able to go and acquire art at first hand themselves would use agents in Rome, people like James Byers, in order to buy the art for them, so that at least they had the art of Rome, even if they hadn't had the experience of it themselves.
Wonderful. Thank you very much indeed.
Alistair Lang talking to Leah Caribbean. Most of the paintings by Battoni to be found in Britain are portraits, as at Uppark. But as the new exhibition will reveal, there's lots more to the artist than that. Leah spoke to curator Dawson Carr at the gallery to ask him what else we can expect from the show.
I think most people in Britain will be surprised because they're going to see that he was not just a portrait painter. In point of fact, Battoni didn't even begin painting portraits of grand tourists until he was virtually two decades into his career. Those first two decades are marked by a number of very beautiful religious, mythological, and allegorical compositions that Battoni created principally for Italian patrons, but also as his reputation developed, he became famous across Europe and things were commissioned from as far away as Berlin and St. Petersburg.
And what sort of pictures are these? Are they colourful, dramatic? How will they look?
Battoni has a beautiful sense of colour. He's an artist who combines the grandeur of Roman design with a very particular sense of saturated, rich colours that enhance and convey the message of these pictures. And these include a very elegant and lovely allegory of the arts in which the art of painting is depicted at center, naturally enough for a painter, surrounded by personifications of poetry, sculpture, architecture, and music. As well, Battoni was a marvelous creator of altarpieces. This was, of course, the mainstay of most painters of the era, religious paintings, that is. And in Battoni's case, he creates a particularly grand one for the Church of St. Catherine of Siena in his native Lucca, in which she's overwhelmed and swoons into the arms of angels.
And what are the portraits? Is there more to them than elegant flattery? Have we been doing Battoni a bit of a disservice, really, by seeing him in that light?
Visitors are going to be able to appreciate that this is an artist who not only creates brilliant swagger portraits, full-length images of Britons posed before objects, statues, buildings, and the like, that indicate their presence in Rome, things that were created as kind of souvenirs of the Grand Tour to commemorate their experience in Rome, but also portraits that show a very different side to Bottoni, portraits that are more intimate, portraits that clearly indicate that Bottoni was very engaged by at least some of the people that he portrayed and came up with novel means to indicate individual personalities.
So there really is going to be a new side to this artist that perhaps we just hadn't really comprehended, certainly not in this country.
Well, it's really more than that, because when the exhibition opened in Houston before it came to London, scholars, curators, art dealers were all of the same mind. And that was that for all of us, getting these pictures all together added up to more than the sum of the parts. It shows an artist who is immensely varied and very, very sensitive to the depiction of the subject, whether it be a person or an episode from classical mythology.
Dawson Carr. So, colourful, intimate, swaggering. Come along to the gallery and get to know the work of this versatile artist better. The show opens on the 20th of February and tickets are available from the gallery or online with a booking fee. And you can hear more from curator Dawson Carr on the exhibition audio guide. Next up.
My name is Anna and I am 7.
My name's Arno Walker, nearly 11.
My name is Abel and I'm 7 years old.
I'm Theo Kandel and I'm 11 years old.
I'm Sam, I'm 13 years old.
I saw pictures of sunflowers in baths.
I saw the Vincent van Gogh.
At Claude Monet.
The petals are yellow.
I came here to see animals and mythical creatures.
I've seen a horse.
Oranges and fruit and stuff.
I like painting dog.
I saw pictures of children.
Battles.
Seeing a lot of good art.
The picture when God made grapes into wine.
It had flowers and there was 3 different kinds and they were in a vase and it was nice.
I liked the horse one because it was very detailed and it was cool.
An art gallery isn't always the first place parents think of taking their kids for a day trip. Too much standing and staring and not enough hands-on is often the fear. But as you've just heard, there's as much here to amuse our smallest visitors as the grown-ups that accompany them. Well over 100,000 children visit every year and find paintings as full of magic and adventure as any storybook. And with half term just around the corner, there are lots of events lined up to keep them entertained, including the launch of a brand new audio guide for families. Its writer, Simon Talbot, told me more.
So, Simon, you've been very busy for the last couple of months writing the audio tour. Can you tell us a bit what it's about?
The premise of the tour is it's the kids teaching their grown-ups, taking them on the tour. If you spend any time in galleries, you'll be aware of the sight of families and kids standing looking slightly glazed while their father or mother pontificates about the brush strokes and composition and basic historical facts behind these paintings, which is all brilliant. We just thought what it would be like if the kids themselves were empowered and had the information to teach their grown-ups stuff that their grown-ups might not have seen because they're too busy thinking about brush strokes and composition, and there's a lot more going on in paintings than just that boring stuff. There's a lot of stories to be told, a lot of excitement and a lot of fun to be had in the gallery, and that's what we're trying to bring out.
So instead of the adults pontificating, we're giving the kids the tools to pontificate at their adults.
That's what we're saying to the kids. It's okay to have fun in the gallery. Look at the pictures. What do they say to you? How do they make you feel? What stories do they create in your own heads? They don't necessarily have to be the given facts. It's just what narrative does it say to you? And freeing them up to kind of have a bit of fun with it. And then at the end of each particular painting, a bell rings, and this is the cue for the grown-ups to take their headphones off, and the kids get a fact, a secret fact that will blow their grown-up's mind. The kids get the fact, and then they have to relate that fact to their grown-up. So they're actually physically teaching their grown-up something that the grown-up probably didn't know. And we're kind of going for the idea behind it is to get the, oh yeah, factor. And kids really, really enjoy, A, having something over on the grown-ups, I know something you don't, and then teaching them. And when the grown-up looks at the painting and notices a detail that they hadn't noticed before, there is that, oh yeah, and the kids really enjoy that and learn as well. It's learning through teaching, which is brilliant.
Right, well, don't tell me what any of those facts are, because you might have to kill me. But what can adults do even if they just pop in for 5 minutes with their children, just to make the gallery a bit more interesting so that you don't kind of get that glazed effect?
I suppose there's several things. Make it fun is, I suppose, the most important thing. It sounds obvious, but it's sort of almost easier said than done. The journey to the gallery is the beginning of the experience. Don't just all sit on the bus. We're going somewhere. You've got to learn. It's very important. Make the journey part of the fun. Build up saying we're going somewhere. There's loads of amazing things. It's an amazing building. You'll see things. Possibly you'll see things from school. Things like the sunflowers. You see them in textbooks. You're really going to physically see this painting. It's kind of like the equivalent of seeing somebody famous. And seeing a painting like that is fantastic for kids because they're huge and vibrant and they're surrounded by other huge and vibrant things. Bear that in mind when you're sort of travelling to the gallery. Always ask open-ended questions rather than say, this painting did this on this date. Say, what's that there? What do you think he's doing? What do you think that smells like? What do you think's happening there? How does that make you feel? And generates a kind of a discussion. I think that's probably the main thing. It's not a case of grown-ups imparting knowledge onto youngsters. It's giving youngsters the freedom to come to their own conclusions, to discover things about the paintings themselves. And I think that way leads to all sorts of fun things that you may not have thought of. Preparation is the key. It's true in DIY and it's true in this. Have an idea, if you can, about what paintings you'd like to see. The gallery is a huge place with lots and lots of paintings, so you don't walk in and you're just bamboozled with so much choice. Have a thought before you leave the house about what would be good, what sort of things are your kids interested in, what sort of things do you think they would like. You can go on the website, the National Gallery website, have a trawl through the collections and have a look and see, they'd like this, they'd be interested in that. Plan in advance. If you haven't got time for that, have a chat with somebody at the reception desk and explain to them the kind of things that you're looking for, and they'll be more than happy to help you out.
I know we said we wouldn't talk at all about what was actually in the tour, but just give us a very vague, loose sense of what we might hear.
I shall be as cryptic as I can, and without sounding too roll-up-y, attend the Teacher Grown-Ups tour and you'll see a petulant angel. You'll encounter the world's worst lute player. And believe me, he's very, very bad indeed. The circus performer's a grotesque old woman, so you've got to be kind to her. A mad, pet-hating scientist. Very difficult to say, but very enjoyable to watch. And you can take part in a beard-growing contest. More than that, I can't say.
Simon Talbot. If your family's planning a trip to the gallery, you might like to be among the first to take the Teach Your Grown-Ups audio tour. It's free and is available from the middle of February. And don't forget, every Sunday is Family Sunday, a day of stories and hands-on fun. See the web for details at www.nationalgallery.org.uk. That's all for now. Join us again next month for all the latest news of the National Gallery's exhibitions and events. Until then, goodbye.